At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's been another one of those weeks, the Dow gyrating back and forth, giving us all the jitters. But hey, if you don't like the numbers, you can always just wait around a while until they're more to your liking. So is this any way to measure the financial pulse of America? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. Sustainability reporting is supported by Johnson Controls, making homes, cars, and workplaces more comfortable, safe, and sustainable. Johnson Controls, where ingenuity is welcome.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal, who's on assignment this Thursday, the 5th day of February. Glad to have you with us. If you're here for the numbers, we'll get to them in just a bit, but they won't explain some of those, shall we say, interesting stock market swings you may have noticed in the past few days. Lately, we can all count on the Dow Jones Industrial Average for the quick thrill, and not necessarily in a good way. To understand these latest lurches, consider this. The Dow reflects an average stock value of just 30 of the largest U.S. companies. 30 out of more than 10,000 companies in this country. And it's price-weighted, which means the value of just one of those stocks can have a lopsided effect in determining the average. So a week like this raises anew this question. Is the Dow a reliable indicator of what's really happening in the stock market? Here's Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson in New York.
James Angel is a finance professor who studies the stock market at Georgetown University. He says because of the formula the Dow uses,
every time a Dow stock moves by a dollar, the index will move by approximately 8 points.
Which means if one of the Dow's expensive stocks, like IBM, falls by 20%, it will drag the average down by a lot more than the same movement by one of the Dow's cheap stocks, like Bank of America. Hence the daily volatility of the Dow and its differences with the broader S&P 500 index. But, Angel says,
as you've noticed, these indices tend to go up and down together.
That's true over the long term, though any Marketplace listener knows that about once a week, the indexes end up doing different things. And you hear this. No reason to distrust the Dow, says John Prespo, the executive director of Dow Jones Indexes.
When you're looking at just one day at a time, you're capturing a lot of what they statisticians call noise, which is meaningless movement that has no significance for the longer term.
So what do the pros use? Here's financial analyst Peter Cohen.
I compare my stock picks to the S&P 500 rather than the Dow.
Though he admits the two indexes are not that far off. And he says if you want an index that'll really tell you what the market's doing right now,
it would probably consist of pawn shops, headhunters, and bankruptcy and restructuring firms.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The name behind Crest, Pampers, Tide, and a long list of other household brands is counting on another familiar name to launch itself in a whole new direction, the franchise service business. Cincinnati-based Procter & Gamble announced today it's taking applications for new car wash franchises it's rolling out all over the country under the brand name Mr. Clean. Is this a good business idea for a bad economy? From the Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
Car washes tend to be scrappy, locally owned businesses without the consistency or even the cleanliness of a big national chain. Nathan Estreth heads up new business development for Procter & Gamble. He says Mr. Clean Car Washes will offer a high-end experience, starting with
a greeter that greets you when you come on the lot, that looks you in the eye, makes clear what offerings you can receive. It includes a sparkling clean environment inside.
Plus, your kids can spray colored soap foam on the car while it's being washed. Aside from the muscle-bound Mr. Clean pitch man, Estreth says P&G has another advantage. There are a lot of laid-off business people looking to buy franchises nationwide. But Don Snigowski, who edits a news website for franchise owners, thinks P&G is overly optimistic.
Franchisees or potential franchisees are very hard pressed. The price of their real estate is down, the available cash is down. It's going to be a real hard slog to get franchise buyers.
It may also be hard to get customers. Gary Anderson is an attendant at Washman Car Wash in Portland. It's attached to a Shell station.
The economy's definitely taking its toll. People aren't willing to spend the money, even though the car that just came through here needed a car wash bad.
Procter & Gamble believes people will still spend money for a new kind of car wash, and the company's also test marketing another branded franchising concept. It's got three Tide dry cleaning stores in Kansas City. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You might actually like where the Dow came to rest today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama is getting anxious. You could hear it in his voice today as he warned that the nation is sinking deeper into a crisis that he says threatens to become irreversible.
The time for talk is over. The time for action is now.
Democratic leaders are hoping to pass the Senate's version of a stimulus package by tomorrow. Let's check in on their progress with the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, North Dakota Democrat Kent Conrad, on the line with us from Capitol Hill. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
As the Senate version of this stimulus bill has taken shape this week, are you satisfied that there are things in there that will actually stimulate what needs stimulating? You've expressed some concern about that.
As in so much of life, it's a mixed bag. There are many elements that clearly are stimulative of the economy, tens of billions of dollars for roads, bridges, waterways, things to rebuild the electrical grid. But there are other things that, frankly, are of less stimulative value that appear to have kind of been stuck in because this is a train that's leaving the station and people had a chance to get their favorite projects added on.
President Obama said today that every day that ticks away, more damage is done.
Oh, I think he's exactly right. I think we are very much in uncharted water. I think we are seeing a potential beginning of a deflationary spiral, which would be extraordinarily damaging to this country. And so it's critically important to have an economic recovery package. But, you know, it's also critically important that we get it right.
Is there anything in particular that you have in mind that you think would bring fast relief as opposed to something that would take a little bit more time?
What we know from the modeling, the econometric modeling done by outside experts, is the thing that works fastest is the government speeding up its purchases of goods and services. The second thing that has most immediate effect is transfers of funds to the states who are otherwise going to cut their own purchases to meet their balanced budget requirements. So the modeling shows those two things go out the fastest and have the greatest immediate impact.
You and members of the opposition party have both been talking about foreclosure reduction plans. What's in the bill that would accomplish that?
Well, there's precious little in the bill now. That's why Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, and I have teamed up on an amendment to provide more than $20 billion to the FDIC, headed by Sheila Bair, on her foreclosure reduction plan. That's probably been the most heralded plan that anybody has come up with that would provide for renegotiation of mortgages that are in trouble, because we know one in every five houses in America, the owners are upside down. They owe more on the house than the house is worth. That means We're going to have more foreclosures. We're going to have more delinquencies. We're going to have an even deader weight on the economy unless we find a way to effectively address it.
So are you hopeful, optimistic, certain that this is going to be on the president's desk by mid-February?
I'm optimistic. I'm very hopeful that we're going to make changes to improve this package. We're trying very hard to do that. At the end of the day, we've got to remember what's at stake.
Senator, thank you very much for taking time out from your work, and we wish you the best of luck in your task.
Thank you, sir.
North Dakota Democrat Kent Conrad is the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee. The lawmakers who've been drafting that bill agreed last night to hand homebuyers a tax break of up to $15,000. The cost of that add-on pushes the Senate version of the stimulus package to well above $900 billion. Commentator R. Glenn Hubbard would like to see them go even further with a plan he's been pushing to have the government subsidize mortgage rates. Mr. Hubbard argues that since housing is what got us into this mess, it just may be the most effective way to turn things around.
President Obama is right to stress the need for a stimulus package to build a foundation for economic recovery. But the biggest bang for the buck lies in housing, the epicenter of the financial crisis. The government can increase housing demand, house prices, and consumer spending with one policy change, by lowering mortgage rates, and it can do so with little cost to taxpayers. Here's how. Remember that the government controls the mortgage market through its conservatorship of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So the Treasury could issue bonds and fund the housing agencies. Their lower costs of funds would enable lower mortgage rates. How much lower? Say 4% on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. A lower rate would still allow an ample spread to compensate for default risk, prepayment risk, and underwriting costs. Current futures markets suggest that house prices will fall by at least 12% in the next 18 months. But lower mortgage rates would put a floor under falling house prices by increasing housing demand and raising house values. Since Americans spend about 5% of home equity on consumer goods and services each year, increasing housing values by as little as 10% could raise consumer spending by about $100 billion per year. And if refinancings at the new lower rate were permitted, millions of middle-income Americans would receive a tax cut averaging $400 per month. Unlike a one-time rebate, this reduction in mortgage payments would be permanent and a much greater spur to consumption. This raises a bigger question. Given the chaos of the recent past, wouldn't a return to simple, long-term, fixed-rate mortgages with a low rate be right for the long-term future? Such simplicity could limit the chance of a future mortgage crisis. Certainly for now, the best foundation for stimulus and recovery is a house, or at least a new mortgage.
R. Glenn Hubbard is dean of the Graduate School of Business at Columbia University. We welcome your thoughts at marketplace.org. There are plenty of other ideas swirling around Washington to give the economy a quick fix. Today, the National Retail Federation reiterated its call for Congress to give consumers an extended sales tax holiday. Would you buy right now if you knew you could save 6, 7, 8% off those big purchases by acting fast? Of course, steep post-holiday discounts didn't seem to persuade shoppers to spend last month. Retailers have been left to unload a glut of apparel and other goods. And that's where the liquidators come in. As Joel Rose reports, business is booming around the businesses that aren't.
The Central New Jersey distribution center of liquidation.com is a pretty good snapshot of the disastrous holiday shopping season, even more than a month later. Pallets are stacked up to the ceiling, loaded with apparel, flat-screen TVs, even food. There are more goods moving through this warehouse than ever before. And it's not just the scratch-and-dent stuff you might be thinking.
You'd see higher-end brands, and you'd see higher-value merchandise.
Bill Angrick is the CEO of Liquidation.com. He doesn't like to talk about particular brands, but I saw Polo, Calvin Klein, Levi's, Sony, Xbox, first-tier stuff. The company uses online auctions to dispose of overstock, returns, and anything else retailers want to get rid of.
They order product as far in advance as, you know, 6 or 9 months. So they don't have the dexterity to react to what's really been a cliff in the drop in consumer demand.
That drop in demand means plenty of work for companies that make inventory disappear. The retail liquidation business is estimated to be worth at least $80 billion annually, a figure that's almost certain to rise this year. Some liquidators specialize in dismantling store chains in bankruptcy, like Circuit City or Linens and Things. Others get their goods directly from manufacturers. Richard Jaffe is a retail analyst at the investment bank Stifel Nicolaus.
When the department stores see business slowing, they cancel goods, they push it back onto the manufacturer. In turn, the manufacturer has to find a new outlet for it.
In the apparel industry, manufacturers often wind up selling to low-price retailers like TJ Maxx and Ross stores. But this year, there's so much extra stuff around that even bargain basement retailers can't absorb it all. So some liquidators are going to extreme lengths to make that inventory go away.
We're in Europe, we're in Africa, we're in the Middle East, we're in Pakistan, India. Ship some goods to Siberia.
Erwin Jacobs is the chairman of Jacobs Trading Company in Minnesota. He's been in the liquidation business for 50 years. Jacobs' company buys name brand apparel, removes the original tags, and then sells it, either in the U.S. or overseas.
We try and keep it under the radar screen so it doesn't compete with our customers' products here. And, you know, you can't avoid it completely. And there's some customers that say, look, even if I get less money for it, I want it exported. I don't want it in this market. And we're capable of doing it.
But most retail misfires wind up closer to home. Back at the liquidation.com warehouse in New Jersey, Anita Luchak and Ezekiel Lascares are picking up cast-off electronics for their mom-and-pop store outside New York City.
We purchase DVRs, combos with DVD and DVD players and VCRs.
And it was cheaper than you could have gotten anywhere else?
Totally. We check in the internet, we check different places, and we got it the best prices from here.
Which means Circuit City's loss could be the couple's gain. In Cranberry, New Jersey, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Coming up, textile workers try to stay insulated from the economy.
Yeah, with the current climate, I feel as good about being here as I would anywhere. I've got friends that work at Wachovia and Bank of America, and I think they're a little more unstable than we are right now.
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets lifted on hopes that more federal aid for banks is on the way. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 106 points, 1.3% to end at 8063. The NASDAQ added 31 points, a 2% to close at 1546. The S&P 500 increased 13 points, or 1.2% to finish at 846. Tech shares gained on bets that looser credit might spur more consumer and business spending. Apple gained more than 3%. Walmart rang up 4.6% after reporting solid January sales. Talk of changes in government accounting rules that would help banks had bank shares dancing. American Express tangoed up more than 4%. Bank of America followed that lead with a 3% gain. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a special guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
State Book, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve Board releases a consumer credit report for December. The Labor Department reports on unemployment for January. And in California, some state-run services may not be open. Workers might start taking mandatory days off as California deals with a budget crisis. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. The White House has announced that Hillary Rodham Clinton's first trip as Secretary of State will be to Asia, including, of course, China. America's dealings with the Chinese could be the most important relationship in the global economy. But the new administration is off to a prickly start, mainly over grumbling that China even helped cause our financial mess. Let's look into this with Marketplace's Scott Tong in our Shanghai Bureau. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Bob.
So how supposedly did the Chinese cause our troubles?
Well, here is the blame China camp, and obviously this is the oversimplified version, assuming the U.S. and China are the only two countries on the planet. But it goes something like this. I'm here in China, and I'm selling you a bunch of stuff, right? I'm selling you running shoes.
Right.
But I undercharge you because I have cheap labor and because the government gives me subsidies. Perhaps the currency is undervalued, so you pay a low, low price, and you actually buy more than you otherwise would. And in return, you send me a whole bunch of U.S. dollars. Now, what do I do with those U.S. dollars? I send them back to the States. I lend them back to you, which does a couple things, right? That's a whole bunch of easy money coming from China, which pushes interest rates down, helps to keep inflation down. And it also encourages you to buy a bigger house. Boom. Mm-hmm. There you have a big ingredient in the housing bubble, fueled, according to this argument, by cheap Chinese credit, cheap Chinese goods.
Well, that's all well and good, but it doesn't really explain the whole story here, does it? We've got bad regulations, bad bankers, bad decisions. So it's not just all on China's shoulders.
That's Beijing's argument that, you know, you people got drunk and you're blaming the bartender. I mean, come on. That's what they're saying. And the other point that China makes is this has not been a very good relationship for China either, right? If China keeps staying addicted to exports, that's not necessarily a healthy way for the economy to grow. It means the factories stay in China, belching stuff into the air. So China's point is it's this codependency relationship that neither side really likes that much. And they take offense at this.
But all this is history right now. We're looking back at that. So why does any of this matter looking ahead?
Well, what you could have is the finger pointing means tempers flare, and then we move down the slippery slope of protectionism and trade wars. I mean, if we take these running shoes that you and other Americans buy, if Uncle Sam slaps this trade tariff on it, suddenly the price goes up, and that's not really juicing the economy and encouraging consumption, is it?
And how bad could this get? I mean, China does have skin in the game here.
Well, that's right. It holds about $1 trillion in U.S. debt. And if it takes too much offense, one scenario is it could start selling off that debt, triggering a crisis in the value of the dollar. Now, on the other hand, if it dumps all its investments, it hurts itself because the value goes down. Also, China isn't the only investor in treasury bonds in the world, right? Americans buy treasury bonds, central banks in other parts of the world buy treasury bonds. So China matters, but perhaps not that much. Now, for now, most people don't think we're even moving toward that direction. The top policymakers in Beijing seem to understand that these political dust-ups happen from time to time, and doesn't seem like they're bound to say anything or do anything stupid right now, and the Americans are backing away from things that have offended China. So for now, adult supervision seems to be the tone of the conversation.
We can hope that everybody realizes we're all in the same boat together, huh?
Right.
Marketplace's Scott Tong in Shanghai. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Bob.
You know, it all depends on your perspective. If, as the U.S. complains, China is cheating with its currency, giving its own businesses an edge over foreign competitors, it's a good thing we've got our own house in order on free trade, right? Actually, take a close look at the latest U.S. farm bill, and you'll find hints that we're protecting our own industries. Example, a textile subsidy program. It's designed to help cotton mills better compete in the face of growing competition from, China. Not that the fabric and apparel industry can't use the help. Here's North Carolina Public Radio's Leonita Inge.
You need earplugs when you walk the spinning floor at Parkdale Mills in Lexington, North Carolina.
Park Dell is one of the top yarn producers in the world. Raw cotton is cleaned and then pulled into long braids that are automatically fed into machines. The cotton turns into thin yarn before your eyes.
It's automatically wrapped, automatically labeled. It's taken off the line and ready for shipment.
Shane Hamrick is the plant manager here. Hamrick has spent all of his career in textiles. He's never been laid off in an industry that's dwindled by 50% in the last decade.
Yeah, with the current climate, I feel as good about being here as I would anywhere. I've got friends that work at Wachovia and Bank of America, and I think they're a little more unstable than we are right now. So I feel good about the future.
In 2005, you could hardly find anybody in textiles who felt good about the future. Imports of cotton underwear, socks, and pants from China were flooding the market. Tens of thousands of textile workers lost their jobs in the U.S. Import caps were put in place to slow down the flood, but those expired last month. Now textile manufacturers are getting support from new subsidies in the Farm Bill. The goal is to help companies like Parkdale stay competitive. The program will pay to upgrade equipment at mills that convert cotton to yarn, basic manufacturing, but it's part of the textile industry where the U.S. still leads in terms of output and quality. Michael Walden is an agricultural economist at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. Walden says the U.S. has a future at the other end of the textile industry.
What's left has moved away from common apparel products to more what I'll call high-tech Texon apparel products, innovative products, products that have industrial use, products that have military use.
Like the fabric NC State developed for the Air Force to make a tent that protects against fire. Blanton Godfrey is dean of the College of Textiles at NC State. He says innovation is the key to the future of the textile industry. We're not talking socks and T-shirts, but components to make cars and sporting equipment.
Instead of a truck body being made out of aluminum, or in the old days, steel, it's now going to be made out of composites, which are textile-based, fiber-based.
Innovation in new fibers is the future. But the textile industry also sees growth in the fiber that started it all. This semester, the College of Textiles sponsored its first cotton couture fashion show. Caitlin Lubati is a senior in the program. Lubati says the textile industry is far from dead. It's just different.
I think of it as an interrelated network of suppliers and manufacturers and designers, and everybody is really working together at this point.
Figuring out new ways to work together could be the biggest survival technique of all in a recession where orders for everything are down. I'm Leonita Inge for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, have you heard about the prominent Manhattan real estate lawyer who wants a refund from his ex-wife? He's suing to get back $2.7 million that he handed over as part of their divorce settlement. He says that was before he realized that the money he thought he was splitting from their joint account didn't really exist, since it was part of the billions lost in the alleged Ponzi scheme of Bernard Madoff. Officials released the full list of Madoff's clients today, 3,657 names in all. And never mind that divorce case, how's this for commitment? Among the names on that list of customers is the lawyer who's defending Madoff against charges he perpetrated the biggest financial fraud in history. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 106 points, 1.3%. The Nasdaq gained 31 points, 2%. And the S&P 500 added 13 points, 1.2%. Stephen Gregory, John Hawes, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the program, the art of debt collecting.
Human beings across the world, especially in the West, they have a tendency to pay. And if you understand that, our job is to work as performing artists and work with customers as partners to find out how can we solve their problem.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.